Now I grew up down an old dirt road in a town you wouldn't know. I still live in the sticks where you wouldn't go. In a town of 1200 off an old dirt road. And a country boy is all I'll ever be.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Mountain Man Dan Show. I'm here with Nick today, but before we get started, I think we need to give a shout out to modern country music. Nick, what do you think?
I think I'm on the wrong podcast. I don't want to talk about modern country music.
I just wanted to laugh at that. You seen that wannabe country boy here last week? He got himself lost on his own 30 acres.
Yeah. You know, even David Allen Coe, completely drunk, can find the bathroom at Logan's Roadhouse. I don't know how he got lost. I'm not even going to go there.
Yeah. No, I was just laughing about that the other day, since this is, the Mountain Man Show. And
man, everybody got all tore up about it, too. They get mad at you when you mention it. It's like, what do you have invested in this guy? Like, why do they get so butthurt over it? I don't get it.
I'm still just not sure how five people total by the end of the whole deal can get lost for 7 hours with four-wheelers on a 30-acre lot. But,
30 acres ain't even that much. I mean,
it's not. Between my property here and what adjoins me that I have the permission and am able to access, we have about right around 30 acres. And I mean, I can walk across it in about the total. I mean, I can walk from one end to the other through the woods in about 10 minutes.
Yeah. I mean, I've went through old cemeteries and stuff that were more than 30 acres in hilly Tennessee terrain, Revolutionary and Civil War era type areas. And I've never gotten lost or had a problem. Never had to use GPS.
Yeah. I just thought it was funny. But anyway. Today's episode, it's going to be one that we've mentioned a couple times, and a lot of people have said that they're forward to it. So we talked with Nick, and we just decided let's just go ahead and get this episode on the road today.
Yeah, and I noticed even just 2 or 3 minutes ago, Jacob even messaged us about it, asked if we were doing a live 1911 episode. So
I just saw the live 1911 episode comment. We're finally doing a 1911 episode. I need to do a little research on how we can get together and do live podcasts and get where I can record live, Facebook Live. But I think it would be cool to get together sometime and do a live video podcast and then just keep the audio to add to the show.
Yeah, we ought to do another one 1911 related with Jacob, because he's a 1911 guy. He's a good dude. He'd be a good guy to have on.
Yeah, I need to figure out the Facebook Live at some point. And we'll have to do that at some point. But unfortunately, tonight's episode is not. But we are here to talk about the 1911. So to get this show on the road, Nick, what are you carrying tonight?
I'm carrying a Ruger SR 1911 5-inch or government model.
And I am carrying a Ruger as well. Their lightweight Commander in 1911, four and a quarter inch barrel with the aluminum frame, and what's up with 230 grain hollow points.
Yeah, I kind of wish usually I always have something strange, and mine's fairly average, so I was kind of hoping I could say something more interesting, like an AMT hardballer long slide or a Javelina 10 millimeter, but no, just a regular old government length Ruger and 45.
Well, that's all right. Mine's nothing real fancy either. It is the aluminum, the lightweight Commander, which makes it a little bit interesting. But there's only a couple of companies that have done the lightweight. I think Colt did a lightweight. I think Springfield may have done a lightweight. Possibly.
Well, they do the EMP. The EMP is aluminum frame, but it's a 1911 based pistol, I think, and it's a little scaled down.
Yeah, the EMP is scaled down for the to the 9mm and 40 caliber cartridges. It's the grip frame shortened and that kind of stuff. I think
nice gun though. They
are a really nice gun. It's very, very well built. It looks like Kimber does a lightweight, weight reducing aluminum frame on the Kimber. And then Smith and Wesson has their what do they call their alloy?
E-series.
Oh, the alloy frame, the scandium or whatever.
Yeah, and the Smith and Wesson scandium. So they have a lightweight, but there's not a whole like you know it's definitely not as common as the standard government model knockoffs. So,
but
But yeah, I posted on the Facebook group and I asked if anybody had any 1911 related questions. And I'm going to keep Facebook open here while we do this, just in case anybody pops up while we are doing this. But yeah, so where do we want to get started at?
Well, you know, we keep throwing around terms like government and commander. I think, you know, for the non-informed, perhaps we should explain the sizes and names and what everything means. Well,
that throws a little bit of 1911 history here. Most people probably know the history on the 1911. But let's go way back. So early 1900s, late 1800s, early 1900s, we were using the Colt 38 short Colt. We went, so originally the first center fire, military firearm, I believe for the pistol was the Colt Model P, the Peacemaker, you know, 7.5 inch, Colt single action army. And then they went to a double action. They went to, I think it was another Colt, 38 short Colt. And then during the Moro Rebellion, they were finding out, oh, it's taken like 4 or 5 good solid hits with this little 38, short Colt to get people to stop doing bad things. So they reverted and went back to the single action army, and that's when they went from the 7.5 inch barrel to the 5.5 inch barrel, cut them all down, sent them over there. And so that's when they started doing the trials for the new service weapon, starting around right around 1900. And there's a few different companies, Colt, Savage, there's a couple other companies. They took some Lugers and some other stuff, and then they narrowed it down, making improvements after each test to finally it was just the Colt and the Savage. And during one of the final tests during, I believe it was 1910, the 1907 and 1911, they did just the Colt and Savage designs. Both designs were improved during each round of testing. And finally, the Colt during 1910, they ran 6,000 rounds were fired from a single pistol over the course of 2 days. When the gun got too hot to be able to really handle it well, they would just dunk it in a barrel of water, and then they'd go back to shooting. They did this with both the Colt and the Savage, and the Colt ran 6,000 rounds with zero issues, while I believe the number on the Savage had like 37 malfunctions.
Wow.
Then they made just a couple more small changes to it. You know, originally John Browning did not design it with the grip safety. I'm sorry, that did not have a thumb safety. It had the grip safety. They wanted the thumb safety added, and I don't remember all the years that they added that they did all the changes. But yeah, so finally after that test, they zeroed down to the Colt. They made a couple final changes, and 1911 was born, and it was. So it was adopted by the U.S. Army in the year of 1911. I believe it was adopted by the Marines in 1913.
Indeed it was.
And so, yeah, so it was used. It would have been used from, I believe it went from 1911 till 1986. So it would have saw service in World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and, you know, whatever other little conflicts we had during that period of time. You know, and then some modernized, you know, some special units, special forces and that kind of stuff still use a variant of the 1911, as well as there's a couple FBI, there's some, I think LD, Los Angeles SWAT team still use 1911s, FBI, a couple of divisions of the FBI still use a 1911. It's still fairly well used in, you know, in the military, some special forces still use it and that kind of stuff.
Yep. Yeah, I think the LAPD SWAT, they use Kimbers, I believe.
I believe they do. So yeah, so during all the testing, you know, they tested the 45 ACP, they tested the I think it was it the 7.65 Mauser and the, or the 7.65 Luger, and then the 9mm Luger, because when they did the Thompson Ligardi pistol round test, you know, shooting, they were killing cattle with these things and actually shooting human corpses, and they come to the conclusion that the caliber should be no less than 45 caliber. And you'll have to pardon me. I'm trying to not talk too fast. I tend to get excited, and I love 1911s, and I start talking fast. So I will try to slow down my speed of speech here a little bit. So,
yeah, and let's not forget too. You know, so you have the government model, which is a 5-inch model. That's the original size. Yeah. And you know, the gun was based off of the research and development of the Colt model of, was it 1908? The 1908 45?
I believe it was actually the 1900s, you know, when they started really, zeroing in from the original 1900 model.
Right, right. And then, so you had the government, which is a 5-inch, the commander, which is a 4.25-inch, and the officer, which is 3.5-inch. Right. And of course, the original cartridges that the Colt was offered in, believe it or not, was 45 9mm. 9mm was out in the 30s for that gun, and the 38 Super, which was a offering during the crime wave. It was designed to penetrate car bodies. It was supposed to be the answer to being able to have the penetration of a 357 Magnum while having the capacity and convenience of the 1911. A lot of G-men use them.
So let's talk about the military variants here real quick. So there's a 1911, and then there's a 1911 A1.
Now, the only difference, the A1 was a lowered ejection port and sights, right?
No.
No, more than that.
Yeah, quite a bit more than that. So if you look at a 1911, so here's the easiest way to tell a 1911 from a 1911 A1 if you're looking at older 1911. And I've got my Ruger in my hand here right now. And if you look on the left side of the frame where there's that little indent where your finger lays to go into the trigger guard, there's a little bit of an indent right there above the ejection, above the magazine release.
Right.
The 1911s, the originals did not have that. That was something they added to the A1. And then they also shortened the trigger. The original 1911 had a very long trigger that filled a lot of the trigger guard, and they went to a shorter trigger. They widened the front sight, and they lowered and flared the ejection port just slightly. Not much as what we see on modern 1911s, but slightly compared to what the original 1911 would have had.
Right.
And they went from a flat arch. They went from the flat mainspring housing to a arched mainspring housing.
Now, what do you prefer, flat or arched?
Flat.
I'm weird. I actually prefer the arched, even though I have a flat in my Ruger. I always like the arched spring housing, but that's just me.
They say the arch makes it a little easier because it kind of brings the back of the hand forward. Or I'm sorry, it brings the bottom of the hand back a little bit. So it makes it a little bit easier for people with smaller hands to reach the trigger. And that's the reason they went to the shorter trigger, is just to try to make it a little more universal for all hand sizes. I have big hands, so I really like the way it feels with the flat mainspring housing. And I have flat mount mainspring housings in all of my 1911s.
Yeah, the Colt that I carried as a duty gun was an arch mainspring housing, but everything else I've ever had has always been flat.
Yeah, so that's the differences between the 1911 and the 1911 A1. There were a few changes made, and then the A1 pretty much ran all the way up until 1986, when I don't think they really had any other changes to the design up until they retired it.
Yep, so, replaced it for the Beretta M9.
Yep. So, then I think it was that. I forget what year exactly it was when we started going into the civilian. I believe, you know, the NRA had a few programs during the early 1900s where people could get 1911s and I think 03 Springfields.
Yep.
Through their match shooting programs.
Mm-hmm.
So there were few early guns available to the civilian market because of that. But I don't really think that we started seeing commercial 1911s until 1920s or so. When we started seeing some Colts come out, and then that's when we started seeing the development of the 38 Super and that kind of stuff.
Right. What would, if you could only have one 1911 for the rest of your life, what configuration would you have?
The one I have in my hand.
Yep. 4 1/4 Commander and 45.
4 1/4 inch, and I like all 1911s, but there is just something away. No, a standard steel frame 5-inch 1911 balances so well, but when you take that 3/4 inch of a barrel off, they just don't seem to balance quite as nicely. But when you add that to when you make it an aluminum frame and reduce the weight of the frame just a little bit with that 4 1/4 inch barrel, they balance and handle so nicely. So yeah, the lightweight aluminum framed commanders are hands down my favorite configuration. But if I had to be stuck with a steel frame, I'd go standard 5-inch.
Right. I think for me, you already know it would probably be a Series 70 in nickel 5-inch government model in 38 Super. If I can only have one 1911 the rest of my life, that would probably be it.
Yeah. And then I'm obviously a 45 ACP guy. So I would go with 45 ACP because I can, with being a hand loader, I can hand load, 45 Super, and with a few modifications to the gun, not including the chamber, I can actually load the thing up to, 460 Roland ballistics. And we'll talk about the 460 Roland here a little later on when we start talking about calibers and 1911s. But, you're still limited to magazine length, even with the 460 Roland. So you don't really gain anything case capacity-wise by going to the Roland case. You just gain the advantage of not being able to accidentally drop the rounds in a regular 45 ACP. But if you're hand loading and you have the gun set up, it's not a big deal just to use regular 45 ACP cases.
Right.
So some of the things I really like to see on a 1911, if I'm shopping for a 1911, the original guns are beautiful to handle, but there are some things I really like to see. One of the things I like to see is a beaver tail. I like a beaver tail grip safety. I like an ambidextrous safety. Obviously, I'm left-handed. The Rugers, I think they do now, but the earlier one did not come with the ambidextrous safety, so I had to add one to this gun. I like adjustable sights, but I really do like I've got pullback sights on this gun. That's the standard with Ruger. That's probably one of my favorite 1911 sights for a fixed sight. Very durable, very, there's almost nothing to snag on in and out of the holster. I like Novak sights. And I like the commander style hammer, the original spur hammers. I just think they're a little ugly, to be honest. I mean, they obviously do their suit their purpose, but the commander style hammers that we see on a lot of the more newer 1911s with the with the loop on the top and different designs, I prefer that style hammer.
Yeah, the ring hammer.
Mm-hmm. Yep, the ring hammer. I like the serrations to be angled for whatever reason. I like original 1911s, but it just bothers me a little bit that the serrations are straight up and down on the slide. I'm sure that was probably it was a military gun. I'm sure that was probably done for ease of machining. I didn't care what it looked like, but I really like the serrations to be angled to the same angle as the grip frame, front and back.
Right.
And like this, the Ruger commanders don't have front serrations. I don't remember if the full size ones do or not. I haven't handled one in a while. But a lot of guns have both front and rear serrations. The most modern 1911s have the serrations angled anyway. I just think they look a little nicer with the angled serrations.
I think for me, I'm not too picky with a 1911. I kind of like them in their standard GI configuration. I mean, if I had to have a 1911 to fight with, I mean, I would totally be okay with just a standard rack grade A1 as it is, but put a good set of sights on it and leave it, and I can shoot that gun fairly well.
Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with that. You know, my first 1911 was not actually 1911. It was a Ballister Marina. Which,
yeah, they don't have grip safety.
They don't have a grip safety, and they don't have a plunger style trigger. They actually have a pivot style trigger.
Yep.
But that was, I've always wanted a 1911 since I was a kid. When I was like 14 or 15, I picked up that Ballister. Shot it a lot. You know, I used to run around my dirt bike all the time, shooting crap off my dirt bike with it. And then my first real 1911 was when I picked up at a gun show in Fairbanks, Alaska. It was, if I remember correctly, it was a Colt slide, military slide, on a Springfield frame. You know, something that was probably, you know, after World War II, going into Korea and Vietnam, these guns were starting to get loose. So they were sent, you know, they were sent in to the armorers, and they went through them and just started cobbling parts together to get, you know, circles again. And a lot of them were, you know, mixed match and that kind of stuff. So it may have been one like that. It may have been one somebody put together later on, but it was rusted and pitted and ugly. And I had that one for a good amount of time. And then before I left Alaska, I sold it to help fund my trip out. And when I got to Texas, I bought a Springfield mil-spec. And I had that one for a while. And then I've had a bunch of Rock Islands, a couple other cheap brands. I had a full-size Ruger like yours for a while. Now I've got the lightweight Commander. I had a Colt Series 70 Combat Commander. I've had quite a few 1911s. And this one I've got right now is definitely my favorite.
Now, what's weird about me is that I've had quite a few 1911s, but I've had more Browning High Powers than I have 1911s.
I've only had one Browning High Power, and it was an actual Browning High Power. And it probably goes along with my dislike for the 9mm cartridge, but I just didn't really care for it, I guess. I still like the 1911
better. Right.
And it ended up getting sold at one time. You know, I needed some money, and you know, when you're young and you need money, guns go down the road. So that Browning High Power, and you know, I wouldn't mind getting another one, playing with it a little more. Maybe my opinion would change on it, just because I have shot 1911s, and I've even shot Glocks more than High Power. We all know I don't like Glocks.
Right.
So it's probably just one of those unfortunate things. I probably just didn't get to play with it enough to really grow attached to it. So, you know, and I'm probably a little biased, but let's talk about the Rugers here for just a second. So, obviously, Ruger makes some really nice 1911s now. And they're really, I guess, budget-friendly. So what are the full-size 5-inch cost? They're about $650, $700, something like that?
Yeah, ballpark, depending on where you get them. Yeah, about $650 to $699, you know.
So they have a full-size heavy frame that they have in 45 and 9mm that are just set up like yours with the Novec sights, fixed sights, and all that kind of stuff. And then they have the Commander with a steel frame in 45 and 9mm. And then they have the lightweight Commander in 45 and 9mm. And then now they have their Target series, which are, I believe, the 10mm and the 9mm are both done with bull barrels. And the 45 is still standard bushing barrel, but they have a really nice adjustable Bomar style sights on them and other nice upgrades. And then now I believe Ruger also has 1911s in their custom shop as well. Now that Ruger's starting to aim more towards competitive shooters, I believe they're offering some 1911s out of their custom shop as well.
And if you're listening, Ruger, please give us a 38 Super.
So, 38 Super is a cool round. My neighbor's got a bunch of 1911s. I think he's got a 38 Super and a couple. He's got like an original Delta Elite 10mm. So, my personal opinion, and again, when you listen to the show, you're getting mine and Nick's opinions. I think that for the money, Ruger makes the best 19. Oh, they also have an officer size now. I'll be dang.
Yep.
And they have their competition model, which I'm guessing is probably So they got their target model. Let's see, 9mm Luger. Okay, so they now have their target model, 9mm Luger with bushing style barrel. So, and they are expensive. They're $2,500. But something to keep in mind, and this is one of the things, one of the reasons I never got into the Ruger 1911s and 9mm, is that in USPSA, you have to have a bushing on the barrel if the barrel is longer than 4 inches. So even commander size with 4 1/4 would have to have a bushing. So I don't think the Ruger target models have a bushing. I believe target models have bull barrels.
Yeah, I believe you are correct.
Yep, yep. The 10mm and the 9mm both have bushing. I'm sorry, bull barrels. Well, the 45 still has a bushing. Those are priced. Their MSRP is about right at $1,000. And then they have the standard, the full size, the commander, and now I guess they also have the officer style. Let's see, what's the MSRP on just the standard stainless, plain Jane? The MSRP on those is $939, but I think they're generally found a little bit cheaper. I think they can be found in that $700 range. So, my opinion, Ruger makes a really nice 1911. They went through, they don't do the Series 80 style safety. They don't do that BS secondary safety. Why Smith & Wesson and Kimber do that secondary safety operated?
What, the Schwartz safety system?
Yeah, we're operated off the grip safety. The grip safety is already a safety. Why we're adding a second safety to a safety doesn't make any sense to me. But they do it. I don't like Series A. So Ruger went with it. They went with a proper Series 70, an original. They don't add anything. They put a titanium firing pin in it, and they added a little bit heavier return spring to it to keep it from having slam fires. And
if you drop a 1911 on its muzzle, a lot of people have said that the firing pin will extend and they'll discharge.
They have said that, but I think, honestly, I think the best way to handle that is a titanium, a light firing pin and a heavier spring. And it does a good job of getting rid of that problem without adding this extra moving parts that just about every other 1911
trigger.
I think Springfield is still, I know Remington has a Series 80. I think all the new Colts are Series, I think Colts does them both ways now. They have Series 70 and Series 80. But Remington R1, don't get me started on Remington R1. I wouldn't touch one of those if you gave it to me. That's for a show some other time.
Right.
I did Remington R1 1911 for a while. I forgot to mention when we were going through the 1911 lesson. It was the worst gun I've ever owned. But anyway, yeah, so Ruger and Springfield, I know for sure, do the Series 70 style, though, the original style where they just added the lightweight firing pin and the heavier spring to get rid of that potential drop fire hazard. And that's the way a 1911 should be. And I think Ruger, they make a good gun for the money, but there's a lot of people that say the Rugers, and I think they're just being a little snobbish because Ruger uses a cast frame.
Right.
Whereas Smith & Wesson has forged frames, and Springfield is forged frames. I'm not sure if Colt or forged or cast.
Colt's forged.
Are they? Yeah. Yep. So we see the cast frames on a lot of cheaper guns like Rock Island.
Paris. Paris were not only a cast frame, but Paris were also cast slide.
Yep. Yep. So they say that the Ruger isn't as good. I've never broke a 1911 frame. I've never even broke a Rock Island 1911 frame. And Rock Island is considered junk. I've never managed to break a cast 1911 frame. So I think that people are just being a little snobbish with that. But yeah, I think Ruger makes a really good gun for the money. If you want the same features on a Springfield, let's look at the features that the Ruger has. Let's just go with the standard 5-inch. So they got the adjustable sights. We got the Novak sights. We've got the beaver tail. We got the ambidextrous safety. We've got the target trigger and all that kind of stuff. We'll go with the MSRP, $900, right?
Right.
So if we were going to go with a Springfield, and a similar, and Springfield makes a really good gun. Do not get me wrong. I like Springfield. But if you were going to go with the same features in a Springfield, I think you would have to jump up to the range officer. Right?
Right. Right.
I'm scrolling through. Yeah, if you want the, if you want those same features in a Springfield, you're going to have to go up to a range officer. So, so the range officer, I think they're about 1200.
Yeah, they're pretty steep. Nice gun though, well equipped.
They make a nice gun.
Yeah, it's very well equipped for the money, especially.
Yep, here's the range 1911. No, that's got. Here we go. Yeah, here's the 1911 range officer operator 45 ACP. And remember, this is a blued gun, not a stainless, and they're 1042. So they are just slightly more expensive, and it's a blued gun versus a stainless gun.
Oof.
So if we were going to go with a stainless range officer, that's not a range officer. That's got the... Let's see here. What are there? Anyway, I'm not talking any crap here about Springfield at all. I'm just trying to show that I think Ruger makes a really good gun for the money. Oh, their Ronin series.
I think a better way to say it would be that Springfield's makes a very good 1911. But as far as value, Ruger is probably the best. You get the most for your money. You get kind of everything you'd want for, you know, really not much more than mid-grade Rock Island money, honestly.
Oh, yeah, 40 years ago, this would have been a better
option. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know, the Ronin, that's pretty close to it, too. That's a stainless. It's a two-tone. Wow, those are actually really reasonable price. Their new Ronin series are priced at about 150 RP. That's actually really reasonable.
That is really reasonable.
Springfield. I'm gonna have to check one of those out. It's got all the same features. It's got the combat style sights, the beaver tail, the loop hammer, the target trigger, front and rear serrations. That's actually a really nice looking pistol. Two twilight own guns for 850 MSRP for about seven out the door somewhere. So I will take all that back. Apparently the Rugers are not that much cheaper than the Springfield, but I still think they're a good gun
for them. Absolutely.
So let's talk about so I know you've had a bunch of 1911s, and you and I, you know, the older I get, the more I appreciate the finer things in life. You know, I'm starting to, and you know, a little bit more expensive whiskey, more expensive guns, the whole nine yards. When I was younger, I didn't really look at the gun overall. I looked at the price. So I bought a lot of Rock Islands, American Tackle.
Hey, the best cheap one I ever had was built in the same Filipino factory as a Rock Island, but it was called a high standard 1911A1, and I got it for $389.99. Because at the time I had $600 to spend, and I was with my friend Lewis, and we went in. Was $389. I bought the high standard, and then literally took the gun, held it over the trash can, and hit the mag button, and let the factory mags back then weren't ACT mags yet. You know, they were just the crap that they come with, and I let it literally go in the trash can in front of the guy that worked at the shop, Dan, that I was friends with. And he handed me five Wilson Combat 47D magazines, and I bought a brick of 250 rounds of 45 and a G&G knockoff of a Galco Combat Master holster. And I walked out for $591, and I walked next door to Captain D's and had lunch. So that was my $600 spent. So it wasn't – actually, it was a really good gun. I probably put 4,000 or 5,000 rounds to that gun, and hey, guess what? The cast frame never cracked.
Yeah, so I've had a couple of the Rock Islands. I've had their Bull Barrel Commander and their full size, their Caracoded. I think it was a Lipsy's exclusive.
Yeah,
that brown Caracode on it. And Rock Island, I mean, if you look at the same features as the Ruger, you know, the You know, let's just say, you know, the sites, the races, you know, all those, you can pick one of those up for like around $500 with all the, you know, the nicer features, and you can get their mil spec one for like $399.
Right. And their mil specs, don't forget the mil specs, all for the same price. You can get them in 9mm. You can get them in 38 super. If you like, the thing I like about them having a cheap 38 super is this. The 45 will do anything you'd ever want a 1911 to do, but there's guys like me that just want to have, you know, we have a bunch of 45s, but we just want one 38 super just so we can go shoot it. Not really a collector, but just, you know, one to have so you can kind of enjoy shooting, you know, one of the different flavors of the 1911. Well, for about $399, you can get one of the Rock Island GS and 38 super if you just want to get your feet wet with a 38 super to see if you really like it before you drop $1,100 on one of the Colts. Like if you're kind of on the fence and you're like, yeah, I kind of want to go 38 super, get a Rock Island first and shoot it for about a year. And if you say, you know, it might be all you ever want is the Rock Island, you know, for the amount you shoot it for what the ammo costs. But, you know, before you go and just dump a ridiculous amount of money, try that first.
Yeah. So here's kind of my outtake on the Rock Island. I've had several, and I really, really liked them. I had very minimal issues with them. Every issue I had with the Rock Island was magazine and extractor related, which most people don't know that the 1911 with a internal extractor, you know, the way John Browning designed it with the internal extractor, is controlled round feed. This is why so many people have feeding issues from 1911s, because they are controlled round feed, and the magazines and the extractor, in order to work smoothly in the way they should, need to be tuned to each other. You know, the magazine has to let go of the cartridge at a certain point so it can pop under the extractor and go into the chamber. You know, yeah, you can drop around in the chamber and drop the slide on 1911 and the extractor will pop over it, but they're not designed to do that, and they will break if you do it too much. So that's, you know, the Rock Island and some of the cheaper 1911s, the extractors aren't tuned very well. You know, they got to be filed.
And not only that, but they're made out of a cheaper, more brittle metal, so they tend to break. But like with my high standard and every Rock Island I've ever bought, if you just want good value, buy a $399 gun, okay? Buy a $30 Wilson Combat Extractor. Buy the extra length ejector, which I think technically is an officer and commander ejector. It's a longer length than a 5-inch. Get that ejector, stake it in. Make sure your plunger tube is staked properly. A lot of times they're loose. Just make sure it's staked. You don't have to upgrade it. They're usually fine the way they are. And I usually respring them. You know, they usually have a 16-pound spring in them. I usually put a Wilson Combat 18-pound spring in them, you know, for modern defense loads. The full-length guy rod, that's an argument a lot of people have had. I've put them in guns. It doesn't really make much of a difference. I just keep the GI plug and GI short rod. But if you'll respring the gun with an 18-pound Wilson Combat recoil spring and you put the same factory weight Wilson Combat firing pin spring in it, and I usually put one of the Wilson Combat bulletproof firing pins in it and one of their hammer springs and, you know, the three-finger spring in the back of the gun, I just go ahead and change everything out with the Wilson stuff and tune the extractor and put Wilson Combat 47D magazines in it, yeah, you're getting up around the $500 range, but you'll find that the guns will run 100% no matter what, run really well that way. And the magazine issues plague them just as much as the extractor issues. And what I have found is the extractor issues are amplified by crappy magazines. They tend to tear the extractors up sooner with a poorly designed magazine.
Yeah, so a lot of, you know, there's a lot of guys that aren't gonna have the knowledge or the know-how or the capability to pull an extractor out and tune it and tune the magazines and that kind of stuff, and that's fine. And with those Rock Islands, you know, if you shoot regular ball out of them, I've never really had an issue. And the same thing with the old Colts. The Rock Islands, in my opinion, are very close in quality. You know, they're kind of loose and rattly. You know, I had my Rock Islands, I pinched and peened the slide rails and, you know, tightened them up and did a bunch of things. And, you know, just like they used to do to the old Colts for bullseye shooting, because they were loose and rattly, and they were designed to be loose and rattly, kind of on purpose. That way, when they got full of dirt and mud and people stuck a magazine that wasn't tuned in there and that kind of stuff, they would still work out in the field shooting rifle ammo. You know, and a lot of people, yeah, they grab a 1911. They'll grab a Rock Island or a heck, it's about any brand 1911. They'll load it up with gold sabers and cheap magazines that it comes with, and right out of the box, like, oh, it doesn't feed hollow points. This thing's junk. And there is an exception to that. The Springfield, not Springfield, Smith & Wesson and SIG are the only two I know that mass-produce 1911s with external extractor. And in my opinion, the external extractor is a major upgrade over the internal extractor, because it can readily pop over the rim of the cartridge if the cartridge doesn't get under the extractor correctly. I think that is a good improvement that Smith & Wesson and
not as classic looking, but it is an improvement.
It is an improvement. It is a little, especially on the Smith & Wesson, but I kind of got that fish scale on durations on the slide. The look of that flat black piece in the middle of a stainless slide with that nice fish scale, it just looks weird, but it is an improvement. It is a good design. As far as magazines go, I'm not going to lie. I still, you know, like the Wilson Combat, like the
47s
or whatever they are, you know, they're designed with where, if you look, give me just one second here. I've got a handful of magazines. I've got a bunch. I've got probably a box with about 50 1911 mags. Give me a second. I'm going to grab a couple. Okay. So I got a Wilson Combat here. I've got a Kimber, and I've got a Factory Ruger magazine. And if you look at these magazines, if you look at the feed lips on them, you'll notice that the Wilson Combats and some of the other more expensive magazines that are well known for working well, the feed lips are tapered versus the other magazines, the cheaper magazines, original Colt magazines, and that kind of stuff. The feed lips are square. And that is to allow the cartridge to kind of slide up and be able to pop under the extractor in more places. Whereas the square lips, that gives a little bit of trouble with the cartridge popping under the extractor right at the right place. And they can be tuned, and, you know, there's a little bit of file work, a little bit of pinching. They can be made to work quite well, but they aren't just going to drop in any gun and work. Versus that's why some of the more expensive magazines work very well, is with those tapered feet.
And, you know, also, I'm kind of old school. Like, I use different magazines for different purposes. With self-defense ammunition, I use the Wilson Combat 47Ds. They have the polymer follower in them with the groove cut into the middle of them to where they kind of get a little bit more angle when they're feeding, to kind of help hollow points feed a little better. But, you know, there are different followers in different magazines. So you have your flat GI follower. That is the follower style you will use with ball ammo. Then you're going to have my favorite magazines, the metal form the follower itself has a big, dent in the middle of it facing up. It has like a ridge on it. That is a wad cutter magazine. It'll work okay with ball, but if you're shooting my favorite load, which is the 100 and grain match semi wad cutters, like the old Federal stuff, that's the magazine to use with it, and that stuff has super low recoil, and it's great for range shooting. And honestly, though, you know, if you're carrying a 1911 and it's an older one and it hasn't been throated, just carry the damn thing with ball. I know that's like a horrific thing to say in 2020, but, you know, even Jeff Cooper carried his guns with ball ammo in them. 45 auto is not like a 9 or a 40 with ball. It's not the over-penetrator that they are, but.
No, I mean, you got a 230-grain gut bullet going 830 foot per second when you're shooting 45 ball. It has plenty of knockdown power, but it's not really a hard penetrator. So people are going to laugh when I tell them this. But Nick, you know, I probably told you, you know what brand 1911 Kimber magazines I run? I run Kimber 1911 magazines. Because they have a standard GI length that comes flush to the bottom of the gun. That is an 8-round magazine where they change the follower in them. And I've never had any issues with them. A little bit of, right out of the box, they've always worked for me really well. One brand, my wife bought me a bunch of 1911 magazines one time for my birthday or Christmas or something. And they were SIG 1911 magazines. And because SIG has the external extractor, they did not design their magazines to work as a controlled round feed magazine. And they do not work. The SIG magazines do not work in a traditional 1911 because the feed lift, if you ever look at a SIG magazine, you'll see what I'm talking about. The feed lifts being designed completely.
They're more like a SIG. They're more like a SIG P220 single stack 45 magazine.
Yeah, they're really. Just because they fit in a standard 1911, they will not feed out of a standard 1911. But something to look at when you're looking at magazines. I've got a Kimber here in my hand, and I've got a Rock Island magazine, actually. And you'll see this on the Wilsons. So when you're looking at eight-round 45 magazines for the 1911 are actually pretty common now. I mean, there's still some 7-rounds, but pretty much eight-round is pretty much the go-to for 1911 magazines and 45. And you'll notice that a lot of the 1911 round magazines look like they have a base plate on them. I got some Kimber ones that have a base plate on them, and I've got these Rock Island ones that have. So if you look at the base plate, you'll notice that on some magazines, the magazine body actually extends down into the base plate, and Wilsons are this way, and like these cheap Rock Island ones are that way because they're probably copies of Wilsons and stuff like that. That is actually a better magazine design because it gives a little bit more room for the spring to compress in there. The Kimbers that I use and like are not built that way. They're actually built to the same specs as a GI magazine. And I like that for a carry magazine. I think I still get the one extra round. I've never had any issues with them. And they fit flush with the gun. So, it, you know, nice smooth bottom on the gun within the holster. You know, a little more slick, I guess, trying to hide it, but my reload does have a base plate on it, so that way I can just have that little extra cushion there when I'm trying to ram a reload into the gun versus trying to make sure a flush mount magazine is mounted flush with the bottom of the gun. That base pad when you're going to do a reload is nice to have, but I carry
it. Now, I'm kind of a bit different than you. I'm very much so a traditionalist, and to me, the 1911 is a 7-round gun. No matter what. So typically I don't ever carry an 8 or 10 round magazine. All my 1911s always have a 7-round magazine, and I carry them all with 230 grain Black Hills ammunition hardball. I've never trusted them with hollow points. The gun was not designed to shoot hollow points. Now if you have like a Springfield EMP or something modern, I'm sure it's fine, but most of my 1911s have all pretty much just been a GI gun or a Colt 1911A1 with a set of sights on it, and that's it. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I'm talking rat tail safeties and spur hammers. And so those guns, I've always run Black Hills ammunition, right. 230 grain ball, and I run a metal form GI follower 7-round flush fit magazine. And I've never had a problem. That's how the gun was designed. That's how John Browning designed it. That's the way it was intended to be. And for reloads, I always found with the flat base magazine, the one man that came up with the technique for reloads that seemed to be very well tailored to that was Louis Auerbach. You know, he trained under Jeff Cooper at Gunsight and eventually became a head range master out there. But Louis Auerbach, if you ever watched the way he reloads a 1911, he goes to he grabs the magazine out of his mag pouch correctly, which is, you know, the palm of your hand is on the actual base plate itself. Your index finger is over the end of the bullet. That way you can find the mag well, even in the dark. And when you get the magazine going up into the gun, he actually, as he is pushing the magazine up, he, with his firing hand, slams the gun down. And so with two motions, they both meet. And it's a very good way to make sure the magazine is seated. I always thought it was goofy until I tried it, and I was like, hey, this works. But,
you know, and I'm sitting here with the gun in my hand right now doing a reload with both my base plate mag and my flat mag. And I so far I haven't had.
Now, I'll say this. The flat base mag sucks under one condition. When you're like me and you are a Clint Smith wannabe and try to emulate everything he does, and you have a lanyard loop on the gun, then it's.
Or how many 1911s do we see these days?
With a Magwell, it's about impossible. You would need a base plate for that. But at that point, I would actually just get the Kimber rubber bumpers for them that go on a regular base plate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. See, that's what I've got on my I've got probably 20 Kimber 1911 mags with the rubber bumper on them. And that's what I carried for my reload when I was shooting USPS.
In my opinion, the best designed rubber bumper for a or base plate extension for a 1911 magazine. It's a good upgrade.
Yeah, but it's just you can put them on almost any flat base magazine. Because they just even old Colt mags.
Metal forms do too. Metal form is pretty much just a good Colt style magazine. I like the metal forms, man. You can get them Midway and get them for $15 for a blued magazine. I always like the blued 7-round flat base plate magazine because that's the traditional standard that the gun was designed around.
Yeah, there's a lot of really good magazines on the market. You know, Wilson Combat makes some good magazines. Chip McCormick makes some good magazines.
The Trip Research Cobras.
There's some really good magazines on the market. When I first got into USPSA, I needed a bunch of magazines, and I was broke, and I went and bought the cheapest 8-round 1911 magazines I could buy at Sportsman's Warehouse, which were the Kimbers. They were like $16 a piece at the time. And after running them for a couple of years in USPSA and shooting around, and that's just what I use now. I've had really good luck
with ball ammo. They're fine. I don't know if I would want to run them with like plus P defense ammunition, 1500 rounds a weekend, but you know, for your standard 230 grain ball or your 185 grain semi wad cutters, I'm sure they're fine for pretty much life until the springs wear out in them.
Now, when I was shooting USPSA, I was shooting the 200 grain semi wad cutter from at the time it was Leatherhead Bullets. Now they got bought out by Gallant Bullets out of Utah. They have a really nice 200, a very traditional 200 grain semi wad cutter, semi mass design, coated lead. And that's what I was shooting when I was shooting USPSA. Those nice square shoulders on those bullets, you can spot your hits from 20 yards away. You know. And I never really had any issues. I can only really recall I broke an extractor one time during a match. And before I really got my – because that Rock Island was, the cheaper gun. I was just starting to learn how to work on 1911s at the time. I tried pinching and peening the slide. So I had a couple – but I never really had any magazine or feeding issues when I was shooting USPSA that I can remember. And then a little while ago you mentioned – the full-length guide rod. That is something that I do like. And the reason for that is this is something about 1911s, is they like to be run wet. They like to be oily. I don't clean mine as much as I should. You know, I carry this Ruger Lightweight Commander all the time. I'm looking at it now. It's full of dirt and grime and dust and sawdust and everything else from working on the house. I do not take them apart and give them a full detail cleaning as much as I should. What I do is I pop the slide off and put some more oil in it and put it back together and run the slide a couple times. Then I go back to whatever I was doing, maybe about once a week. And the full length guide rod allows you to pop the slide off without taking out the barrel bushing and all that. You can just pull the slide back, push the pin out and take it off with the barrel spring and everything still, in one piece, put some extra oil in it, look it over, see how dirty it looks inside, smack it back together, put the pin back in, and away you go. Where you can't do that with a short, you actually have to take the
pressure
and release the pressure off of the spring. So I do like the full length guide rods. And I like coil springs, the flat wire springs. If I'm going to change a spring in, I usually spend the extra couple bucks, buy the new guide rod. And I'll buy a flat
coil. Yeah, flat wire springs are dramatically different with service life. I mean, huge.
Three or four times as much. And I shoot my 1911. Like when I was shooting a USPSA, especially, you know, I played around with the shock buffers for a while. You know, they say that those help from peeing the front of the frame. It also shortens your stroke a little bit, you know, that 1/8 or 3/16 of an inch thick that shock buffer is. it shortens the stroke of the gun, so your ejection becomes a little bit less reliable. And then as those things mushroom out with use, they will start to kind of bind up. So I don't use
I used to use them early on, but I just use a GI guide rod, short rod, and 18-pound spring. I'm pretty basic with a 1911.
Yeah.
And I really go modern. I just get a modern handgun.
You know, and I carry one quite a bit. You know, I carry my 250-grain penetrating load quite a bit. But if I carry factory ammo, I really like the Hornady critical duty and critical defense. I've never had any feeding issues with those in a 1911 with any magazine. It's kind of got that pointed bullet design. They feed really, 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 really well.
Yeah, I was always a Golden Saver man when it came to 45 stuff. But typically, I always just ran Black Hills ball. But
yep, and as a matter of fact, I have mine loaded with 230-grain Golden Saber right now because I had some on hand, and it's a good carry-around, too. It's got enough taper to it. You know, when they designed that, it's an old enough design. They designed it around the older 1911s, so it's almost got a ball shape to it, and those feed really well. It's when you start getting into, like, the Federal Hydro Shocks and that kind of stuff that have a really wide open hollow point where they really start running into issues. And there's other things that can be done to help fix that issue. You know, you can mill out and put the 1911 traditionally is a two-piece barrel where the feed ramp is part [S2] Right. [S1] Of the frame. And you can have them milled out and put one-piece barrels in there where the feed ramp is part of the barrel, like it would be on a Glock or anything like that. And that is a huge upgrade. Some guns come, like, I think STIs and stuff like that, the real expensive 1911s come with that as a factory option, but it's expensive. You know, you're gonna have to take your gun to a gunsmith unless you are, you know, you have the ability to do that yourself, and have the frame modified to take that other barrel. And but it is a big upgrade.
Yes, it is for sure.
I think Para was the first one to really capitalize on putting that in their factory guns. And then now we got the new generation of 1911. We have the 2011s, you know, which have a polymer, kind of a modular frame, you know, double stack, single stack. You can, you know, kind of change the grips and do different stuff with that. I like a 1911 to me has to be a single stack. If I'm going to go a double stack gun, I'm going to go for a double stack gun. I'm going to go get a, you know, something that was designed to be a double stack. I like my 1911s as a single
stack. Yeah, you know, I don't know. The double stack stuff's pretty cool, but for me, it's a 7-round single stack, 45. I'm very traditional. I prefer single stack 1911. It to me, the double stack spoils how it feels in your hand.
Well, I like the 8-round magazines, and I really like when I was shooting USPSA, you know, having one extra round in the magazine on a stage, because a lot of stage arrays are designed to be 8-round arrays. So if you've got 8 rounds in the gun, including your magazine, you know, so let's say you got a round in the chamber and 7 in the magazine, and you miss a shot. Now you either have to just take the miss, or you have to do a reload, and then you're a round short every, you know, for the rest of the match. Whereas having an 8-round, you know, 8-round mag plus a round in the gun gives you a little bit of a cushion there if you miss or something. You need to do a makeup shot. And 45, with USPSA, with 45, you get, what's called major scoring, which means you're limited to 8 rounds in the magazine plus 1 in the chamber. If you shoot 9mm or even 40, but most 9mm mostly, you can get away with what's called minor scoring, which you take a point less for every hit that is less than an alpha. So, you know, Delta or Charlie Delta shots would be, you know, 3 points versus 4 points or whatever the point would be, but you're allowed an extra 2 rounds in the magazine. So, you know, if you're good enough of a shot to shoot alphas all the time, there's no reason not to go with the 9mm. Then when you're shooting steel, you get, you know, a little bit of a cushion there with that extra back, you know, extra round or two for makeup shots. But yeah, so I really got to like the 8-round magazines, and there's so many 8-round magazines on the market that are good magazines now. It's not
right.
1911 and 8 plus 1 now. So, and you know, if I was going to get back into USPSA, and I want to, I just bought a new Hornady. My birthday's next week, and I just got myself a new Hornady Progressive Reloading Press for my birthday, and I'm kind of starting to lean toward maybe getting back into competitive shooting after the work season ends this year. And I'm probably going to end up shooting 1911s because that's what I enjoy shooting. When I was shooting before, I started with 1911, and by the end, I was shooting Glock, and I did really well with the Glock. But I carry and I enjoy shooting 1911, so that's probably what I'm going to kind of lean towards when I if I get back into competitive shooting. And I'm probably going to get one in 9mm because normally I shoot, you know, pretty center, and that extra couple rounds in the magazine
is a
nice bonus.
Yeah, I think if I was to get into competition shooting again, I'd probably start shooting with a 1911 too. But I would probably get into a single stack 38 Super, probably a Colt done up like a competition series or, you know, Combat Elite.
Shoot open class 38 Super comp with an 8-round magazine.
Yeah, that sounds like a good time.
Got to keep up all these people with full blown race guns with a single stack with iron sights on it. That sounds like really worth. Let's out with 1911. I mean, we've been kind of rambling on for about an hour now.
Dude, we have 1911s. We could probably go on for 10 hours and not cover everything.
Dude, I could talk like when it comes, you find a gun that I like, and I can talk all night. If you want to do a 4-hour episode, let's do a 4-hour episode. But I don't know how long our listeners are gonna
right.
They're gonna if we do a 4-hour 1911 episode. But yeah, I mean, I love 1911. It's probably my favorite bottom feeder.
Yep, definitely.
And you know, and there's some really good ones out there. The only brand I would probably really avoid, if I was going to go out and buy a new one, would be Kimber. And it's not because Kimber doesn't build good guns. I think they do build some good guns, but they just, there's more things that can go wrong with a Kimber, especially when they have that, you know, add a safety to a safety, different kind of thing. Triggers aren't quite as good. And they seem like they're a little more, what's the word I'm looking for? A little more, delicate, I guess, or not delicate, but you know, just trying to get them tuned just right. So they run. They just seem like maybe needy. They seem a little more needy.
Yeah, I'd say that's a fair assessment.
But it's not that they don't make a good gun because there's a lot of, you know, they got a forged frame. And actually, for a long time, Smith & Wesson, I think, forged the frames for Kimber before they started their own line in 1911. You know, Smith & Wesson has forged frames for Kimber, Wilson Combat, a bunch of other different manufacturers before they got back into making their own 1911. So, yeah, I mean, but that's probably about the only brand. No, and Smith & Wesson does that same thing with that double safety on the grip safety deal, but Smith & Wesson has some really cool bobtail 1911 white and slides with that external extractor that are, you know, carry ready out of the box. Jeff Quinn carried a Smith & Wesson 1911, and although I don't like that double grip safety deal where it doubles as a firing pin safety also, they do make a really, really nice gun with a lot of features for the money.
Yeah, they definitely do. And they're good looking guns too.
Yeah. So let's just real quick, let's touch on calibers, okay?
Okay.
So 22s. We know there's 22 1911s. How much do you know about the 22 conversions?
I know that they typically don't work.
There's actually some that work pretty good. So Colt designed what was called the Colt, I believe it was the Colt Ace conversion, which had a floating chamber. And I've never really messed with one, but I do know that they worked pretty well, and they worked in such a way with that floating chamber that it mimicked the recoil of shooting the .45, so that, you know, for training purposes.
Interesting.
And they were used quite a bit during World War II, and then they hit the civilian market. And I think my dad had one. We used to shoot it when I was a kid, but I've never really played with one now as an adult to really see how they work. And then there's a bunch of cheap, like, Cimarron 1911 22s, and they're pretty crappy. Rock Island makes a, and I think Browning makes a baby 1911 that they chamber in 22 long rifle and 380.
Yep.
And those are cool.
They are. They're neat. And then Llama had one too. The what was it called?
Llama 1911.
Well, they're not really a 1911. It's just Llama.
Not.
I threw up in my mouth a little bit. I'm not a huge fan.
Anyway, no, that's all right. They got those little baby 1911. Those are pretty cool. What they can fit. Like a 3/4 scale full size. They look exactly like a regular government model 1911, 3/4 size and 380 or 22, and those are really cool guns. But yeah, for full size 1911s, we've got the 22 conversions, then we got 9mm.
My uncle's got 357 SIG,
38 Super, 40 Smith and Wesson, 10mm. 357 SIG. Kunin actually had some
1945 Winchester Magnum.
Other brands that the Grizzlies and that kind of stuff that were like 357 Magnum.
Don't forget the Parker Wyoming in 10mm.
There was a bunch back in the day during bullseye shooting. There was a bunch of Well, 10mm is a pretty common chambering, but yeah, back in the bullseye shooting days, when that was common, in the 70s and 80s, when 1911s were becoming really available to the public, the military ones,
those were quite
a few, and you can still find them on GunBroker and stuff, that were converted to shoot 38 Super special wad cutters. And those are really cool guns. That's really a pretty cool piece of competitive shooting history if you can find those. And the ones that were done by like Packmeyer, I don't know if Packmeyer did any, but I think Wilson did some of it. But yeah, those were some really cool guns.
Yeah, there's been several 1911s converted to shoot 7.62 by 25.
Semi-auto. Somebody makes a barrel or a conversion to be able to shoot. Yep, I've seen that or 7.62 Mauser and different stuff. Like it really, there's so many different calibers. It's not even fine, man. You know, like Smith and Wesson, Springfield. Now they got EMP series, you know, which is scaled down. It's like a 4-inch barrel, but the frame is scaled down to really kind of suit the 9mm and the 40 better. Those are really cool guns. But yeah, and then you get into, you know, like you got the 460 Roland. You really want some performance, you know, 10mm. I've kind of got a hard on for the 10mm. I don't really like it. Just because so many people praise it to be, you know, the end all on handgun stopping power, and I don't think it is. But yeah, the 10mm 1911s. If you want something with a little bit that hits pretty hard, you got those. You got the
absolutely, especially if you get into like a 6-inch long slide and 10mm or 45 Super, or you know, I don't know why no one's made a 6-inch long slide 38 Super yet. Can you imagine the velocity you can get out of that?
That'd be pretty cool. So two other things that we need to touch on here real quick. A couple of years ago, I was doing some research on the 1911. When I first got into gun writing, I wrote an article on the 1911.
Right.
That was like my first or maybe my second history essay. And I'll see if I can dig it up and post it to the Facebook page. I think the article is posted on Hub Pages. So I'll see if I can dig it up and put it on the Facebook page. But let us not forget that during World War II, there was a gentleman,
yes,
I think Patrick Owens might have been his name, who shot down two Japanese Zeros with a 1911. His airplane got shot down. He's parachuting down, and the Japanese are kind of dive bombing him, trying to hit his parachute and kill him. And yeah, he managed to down two Japanese zeros with 1911. That guy is probably my all-time hero. So let's not forget about that. And then
I don't get points. I don't understand the point of a comp on 1911. That's just me.
If I see. Okay. So the bushing comp, if you're going to put a comp on a 1911, like 460 Rolander, 45 Super or 38 Super or anything where you really want to have, and there's definitely some advantage to having a real comp on a gun. Spend the money, have a real comp, put on a threaded barrel the correct way. If you want to put a bushing comp on a 1911, go ahead and buy yourself a plane ticket to Fairbanks, Alaska first, and I will meet you at the airport and slap some sense into you before you buy it, because there's so many problems that they can cause with, you know, breaking lugs off and cracking slides and all kinds of different things that they can.
I mean, honestly, if you're only going to do the bushing comp, you're better served just doing a single piece guide rod and adding some weight into the dust shield. It will do the same thing.
They can actually physically harm your gun. I know Frank Castle looked really cool on the Punisher with his compensators on his dad's 1911s. But if you ever look and watch that movie closely, when he wraps the slide, the comp does not move. They were real correct compensators on those guns. Just avoid the bushing comps, please. Other than that,
no.
Nick, I think we've got we covered
you
can a
think
lot.
Of. You're more of the 1911 guy than I am, but
okay. I 1911. I've done a lot of reading about him. I know a fair amount about him. I don't consider myself an expert by any means, but I know a fair amount. But yeah, we're at well over an hour on this episode now. I think we probably got to start thinking about wrapping it up. So, in future episodes, if anybody has any 1911 questions that they want answered, send us an email. So hit us up on Instagram. Nick and I are both on Instagram, YouTube, Facebook, anywhere you can find us at. Shoot us a message. Hey, you know, what do you think of this model gun, or what do you think of these magazines, or what do you think of these sights, or what would you do? I'm having a small problem with my gun. What do you think I should do? Send us a message. If we can help you just on the messages, cool. If you want us to talk about your problems or your ideas on the show, that's cool too. Send us a message, and we'll
it's never too
show.
Weird and too strange for me. If you want to talk about NAMBU 8mm and
something you want to hear
tacticalizing one, then let's do it. I'm up for anything.
Now, Nick, like. Yeah, I'm down with this about ever. And then I'll do a little research on. I know we had questions about the Facebook Live podcast. I will do a little research on that and see if we can make a Facebook Live episode happen at some point. But I am not computer or tech savvy, so I'm gonna have to go to YouTube University and learn how to do that. So, other than that, I do appreciate everybody always tuning in to listen. You know, I know we go through some pretty big gaps sometimes, not putting episodes out, because Nick and I both have pretty crazy work schedules and this kind of stuff. But we're gonna try to start doing a little more regular, maybe recording extra episodes when we have time, so that way we have something to put out during the lean times. You know, during the famine, we still have some grain stored up for the famine times. But, I appreciate everybody tuning in to listen. I hope you enjoyed our 1911 episode. And I...